Welcome to the Big Self Podcast. I'm your host, Chad Prevost.
And I'm your host, Shelley Prevost. We are the podcast for the Big Self School, and we offer classes, coaching, and books to help you rediscover your purpose and activate it in bigger ways.
Katarina Kostula is joining us today. She is an executive coach and founder of The Leader Path. Her mission is to coach pioneering leaders and teams for meaningful impact and fulfillment.
Prior to The Leader Path, Katarina was a global business leader at Google. She managed some of the company's largest C-level partnerships there. She was also an internal coach, awarded a 5-star rating distinction from her coachees.
Katarina has coached leaders from Google to Amazon, Vodafone, Ferrero, Workable, many entrepreneurs. She collaborates with NSED, coaching executive MBAs and alumni. She's a member of the Forbes Coaches Council, and she's lived in more than 7 countries across America, Europe, and Asia, and now lives in London. We're so excited to have her on the show. Katarina Kostula, welcome to the show.
Hey, Katarina.
Hello, I'm very happy to be here.
We're so glad that you're here. It's afternoon there. You're in London, right?
Yes, indeed.
Yes, the morning here. I've got my coffee and I'm really looking forward to this conversation. I've been looking at your work and your amazing company online. And so I'm excited to have this conversation. So we want to just jump in this morning. So you've written a book and I just told Chad, I'm like, this is brilliant.
A book on meetings.
A book on meetings, because as someone who, lived and worked in the business community for a very long time, it was the bane of existence for so many people to have to sit through meetings. So I think it's brilliant to have a framework for thinking and helping people make the best of something that we have to do. So tell us a little bit about your book and kind of why you decided to write it.
It was similar to me. When I was in corporate life before I launched my own business, I found meetings, especially internal meetings, insufferable. And yes. I thought it was just me. I realized it wasn't only me. When I left corporate world, I was, yes, I'm free of meetings. And I have to say, until this day, I say no to most meetings. I have 2 days a week that are meetings free, which I found is pretty rare. And then when I became a coach and started coaching leaders, I kept hearing complaints about their meetings. Well, the first complaint that they were ineffective, either they didn't have an outcome, they wouldn't achieve the outcome. The second, that meetings were miserable. We feel frustrated or bored or sometimes stressed, excluded, disconnected. And the third complaint was there were too many. And even if you have good meetings, if you have too many, it's exhausting. Because for us, meetings, we perform in a certain way. It's a stage. You have to listen and say certain things. So it's exhausting. So because my clients were suffering with collaboration, even though they were in back-to-back meetings, I started offering team coaching. And then soon enough, I realized team coaching became the best part of my work. I loved it. We had real conversations. The teams were pumped up about pursuing their purpose. They have the sense of belonging. And then it dawned on me, team coaching sessions are also meetings. What's going on here? Why some meetings are the best part of the work and incredibly fulfilling, and most meetings are not? And that's what prompted me to explore this and try to ease the pain. And in reality, meetings and leadership have a huge overlap. Like if you define leadership as guiding a group to achieve a common purpose, meetings is bringing a group together to achieve a common purpose. You can see the overlap. You cannot be a great leader and have the impact you want unless you're able to bring people together to achieve something. And that's meetings. But also, But also it's our inner needs as well. And I know you believe inner growth leads to external impact. Our inner needs, the need of belonging and the need for power, of the need to be able to make a difference, are really touched by meetings. When the meetings are good, you feel that you belong and you feel powerful because you have a team around you. But when the meetings are bad, you feel lonely and disconnected and powerless. So it's the inner needs for the external impact. That's why we have such a visceral reaction to meetings.
Yeah, very nice. And, you know, and meetings can go sideways for a lot of reasons. But so tell us about your overall framework. How does it work? What's the idea behind it?
So the idea, it's called the 4D framework. And the idea is that you only need to hold a meeting for four outcomes, and they all start with a D to make it easy to remember. Mm-hmm. So you only need to have a meeting to define a problem or a goal, to develop ideas, to decide or do something. So that's the 4D framework. You can have a meeting for one of the 4D outcomes, or you can have for more than one 4Ds. This is steps in a process. If you realize it's a design and thinking process, to solve any problem, you need to define it, develop ideas, decide and do something. And what's important is if you're pursuing more than one of these outcomes in your meeting, you let everyone know this is what we're doing now. And you when you transition again, you let everyone know. So even with that, being clear on the outcome and bringing the people, creating this awareness of this is what we're doing right now, eliminates a lot of the chaos. And also this framework eliminates a lot of the unnecessary meetings, like the information sharing meetings that you don't need to. For them to happen at the same time, you can send a video or an audio or an email. And I think It makes meetings a lot more inclusive, because for these 4D outcomes, you benefit by having everyone contribute. You will have a better outcome.
So here's what I'm thinking about. I'd love your perspective on this. So I'm thinking about trust, and some of the worst meetings I've ever been in, probably early on in when I was working with, had just joined a venture capital firm and was new to, I was kind of the outsider. I was a psychologist in with, you know, a bunch of partners, and they were all in finance and investment and business guys. And I felt so outside of that group. But there was no trust. And so the meetings were awkward, and no one really could lean in and talk freely because we just didn't have a sense of trust with each other at that point. So I'm really interested in how you tackle that with teams, because the way you just put those side by side, I really see it. Like, team coaching can be invigorating and like really powerful for people to come together and have these collaborative conversations. But I think the point of a lot of those coaching meetings are to build trust. And then in a lot of like corporate meetings, people reduce trust building as inessential. And like, that's not what we're here. We're here to get a job, you know, just to work. So how do you incorporate trust into some of these, into your framework? Because it's like you have to oil the runway before you can take off, I guess. I'd be really interested in how you think about trust in your framework.
Absolutely. So first of all, in the book, there's a whole chapter about how to start a meeting. And there's plenty of research that you will have a lot of better results if you spend some time in the beginning connecting. And when I do team coaching sessions, I usually recommend spending 30% of your time in the beginning and the ending of the meeting. I think both are important as a rule of thumb. But we will spend time in sharing something personal, all vulnerable in the beginning. And the leader needs to model this and needs to start. And this will break a lot of the ice and will create these conditions that when you have an exercise to sharing something vulnerable in the beginning, it could be even as the win of the week and the challenge of the week. Even that for team coaching will go a lot more in personal information. Then you're more likely later to share vulnerable information like mistakes you've done or disagreements. So that's one of the way you set the tone in the beginning, and you invest the time because it will pay off later when people are more honest and bring their true ideas and their psychological safety. Mm-hmm. But there's more you can do. Like, you want to, a lot of psychological safety and inclusion is the leader needs to model it. So,
which is, I think, a huge problem that I experienced. A lot of times the leaders, they want to kind of dominate the time and kind of show off how much they know.
Yes. And that's another, you're right, because sometimes a leader only feels like a leader of a team during the meeting. So they take it as an opportunity to enforce their authority, if you wish, or demonstrate their authority, or all of these things. But in reality, you will establish your authority as a leader a lot more if you create this safe environment where people can interact and they can produce these great ideas and they can make these great decisions. Mm-hmm. So model vulnerability as a leader. It's really important how you deal with people that will bring a dissenting view. Like, people will notice as a leader, what do you do if someone disagrees? Or how you welcome the dissenting views will set the tone for the meeting. And then in team coaching, we'll do a lot of exercises, like feedback exercises. And it's my job there to hold the safe space, that to allow the team to be able to give feedback to each other, which will help them later work a lot more productively together and build that trust that it's okay, we can disagree on something, but the personal relationships are not damaged.
Okay. Well, yeah, that sounds awesome. Well, we've mentioned a couple of things from our personal experience. What, from all that you've seen, all the research that you've done, what is, would you say, the most common mistake that people make in meetings?
Other than not having a clear outcome they want from the meeting, which is what the 4D framework covers, I would say is not defining the problem they're trying to solve. I have observed many meetings in my research for the book and as a part of my team coaching. And as humans, it's normal. We need closure. We need to go into solution mode. But what happens, unless we spend some time to really get on the same page of what are we solving for here, we either solve the wrong problem, or each one of us is trying to solve a different problem, and there is chaos. That's where a lot of the chaos comes from.
This makes a lot of sense. This is speaking to me. I mean, Shelly and I have been working together, and you know, I think sometimes when we have meetings, Shelly, we should have a little bit more specific outcomes in mind.
Well, I do. I think that's good. I do ask myself, I try to, I mean, it's not 100%, but what is the goal? Like, what is the goal of this meeting or this conversation or even this email? Because I think as a therapist, as a psychologist, I can be a little bit too process oriented and not outcome oriented. So I really have had to train myself to think about like exactly what you're saying. Like, what is the goal here? What's our outcome for this?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I want to ask about, this idea of the lonely genius. I'm really interested in that. So, and I have some assumptions about what you might mean by that, Katarina, but I'm curious, you know, what did you learn and what are you seeing with this myth of the lonely genius?
Yes, that it is a myth. So
it's not true.
It is not. It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So from the beginning of time, humans leapfrogged evolution through collaboration. If you take any human against most animals at an individual level, we are weaker. But when we collaborate together, that's why we achieved so many things. Mm-hmm. And I stumbled across some research which was pretty incredible. Academics took more than 19 million scientific papers and more than 2 million patents. And what they found was that the scientific papers and the patents that were created by a team were cited twice as much as the research created by an individual. Mm-hmm. So the data is conclusive that when we work with teams, we will have a lot more impact. But we have this tendency to attribute disproportionate credit to lonely people, to the lonely genius or to the leader. Mm-hmm. But think about the Beatles, McCartney and Lennon. They were creating together and all their songs, they were sharing their profit equally, and they will have both their names. Or think about the Wright brothers when they created the airplane. According to their journals, they were really working closely with each other. And behind each piece of progress, there was a team behind it. And that's why the myth is damaging, because sometimes we're trying to do everything on our own rather than getting a team to help us. Or for businesses, we hire brilliant people, but we don't get them to work together in a good way, and then we don't have the results we would aspire for.
Yeah. And all the more reason I would think now that we're, you know, we've been sequestered, many of us, to working from our own homes. Okay. So if we're functioning at a little higher level, we're collaborating. So meetings can be our friend, you're saying. Other than what you've already said, identifying a specific outcome for what the meeting should be trying to solve, when should we have a meeting and when should we not?
So I argue that we should have a meeting for the 4D outcomes: define, develop, decide, and do. I would share with you some reasons, not so good reasons, to have a meeting. One is the information sharing that I already mentioned. You don't need to do most of the information sharing doesn't need to do in to happen in real time unless it's an extremely emotional update. If you're firing someone, please tell them to their face, don't send an email. But most of the information sharing can happen in other ways. It doesn't have to happen in a synchronous way. Another bad reason is the convenience of the leader. Imagine you have to share some information. If you write an email, it will take you an hour, let's say an important email. You invite a half an hour meeting, your 8-people team, and you're done. It feels good. You, in half an hour, you've given the update, you go back to work. But what you've done really is you absorbed 8 half an hours from your people. So that happens a lot. A lot of the meetings happen because it's a more convenient for the leader. Mm. And then a third one I want to highlight is the reason for networking and cohesion. Cohesion and team cohesion is extremely important. It's even more important than experience to the performance of the team. You want the people to have a personal relationship, get along with each other. But the wrong solution is that I've seen is having a lot of meetings, especially status meetings. There's reasons that 17% of people will prefer to watch paint dry than being a status meeting. It's the worst. Yes. It's the worst thing you can do to build relationships. If the relationships is the goal, social time will work better. And be clear, this is what we're doing. This is a networking event. This is a team building event. Even in a virtual world, I know it's more challenging, but don't have a status meeting when the real objective is to bring the team together to build better relationships.
Yeah, one of the things I'm thinking about is ego management. I think that's a thread of what we're talking about, whether it's in a meeting, whether it's a collaboration, and I don't know if you have anything to say about that, but I wanted just to highlight that. I do think there's something really essential about self-awareness and us understanding when our ego gets stoked, whether we need to kind of like, you know, monopolize the meeting, or when we have things that we're hijacking, or we have an inability to give credit to somebody else. Like, there's a lot of ego management that is essential for people to really work well in a collaborative way, whether it's a meeting or outside of a meeting. How do you coach people around that? Like, understanding when their ego is in full force and kind of driving their work. And what do you do about that?
Sure. I like to dive deeper behind the ego because usually it is a deeper human need. And for example, it's hard to not go to some meetings, even if they're not helpful or useful to us, because we feel excluded. And exclusion in the tribe environment, if you were excluded, you would die. So that's one of the reasons we invite a lot of people to our meetings, in order to stroke their ego, not to hurt their feelings. But it is a real human need. People may feel excluded because it goes into the deeper levels of, oh, I need to be in every meeting. And also, it is true, we need to recognize that there is availability bias and recency bias. So if someone is trying, for example, to get a promotion, they will try to speak a lot in the meeting and go to many meetings, even if it's exhausting and not useful for their purpose, for the bigger purpose, because there's a part of truth in this. It is likely that if people see them more often and see them more recently, they will remember them when promotion time strikes. So how do you deal with this? Like, we need to know, see all these dimensions. I think meetings are exhausting if they're not really purposeful and inclusive and really thought out and well prepared. So we need to manage this. And I advise people, be aware of all the psychological needs. How can you manage your stakeholders, for example, to say, I really need to focus my time on something more productive rather than being in all these meetings. How can you, when you are in a meeting, make it the most productive possible? These are some thoughts I had on this topic.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think that's, there's power even as a coach in being in a part of these meetings and witnessing like where do your clients kind of get, go unconscious a little bit, where the ego kind of takes over. And those are the places I think that are really helpful for them to unpack, and, you know, do some work around, because we're not always aware of when that's driving our conversations.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's probably hard to know how much you should keep on struggling through the hard times in order to get to the good. I'm sure, you know, it's different for different people, but you know, Gary Vee says it's going to be really hard for a long time at first. And you hear that famous quote, the only way out is through. How do you help your clients, you know, whether it's ego management or something else, how do you help them ascertain the difference between when the going is tough and they need to get going and when they should consider opting out?
I love this question because I do have very controversial views on this topic. And I've read an article that success feels easy when you're on the right path. I'm a big believer that we need to follow the joy. And if there is no joy, we need to stop and reflect. So even Gary Vee, and I researched his story because for this article, I researched all the people that we use as examples that the going is really tough in the beginning. If you see the story of Gary Vee, he was extremely successful really early on. He got a $2 million business from his father. It became a $40 million business. He was a 30 under 30 before he's 30. And he's doing things he enjoys, like social media. Yes, like this, the YouTube channel took off after a year or so, but he had extremely good feedback for what he was doing. Like the revenue was growing, he was having fun. So what I tell my clients is, if you feel you're struggling, and I'm talking about how you feel internally here, let's take a pause and see what's going on. Because a lot of the times our body is trying to tell us that we're doing something that is not the right thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, and you could, speaking of Gary Vee, you could just sense the infectious enthusiasm. I remember when he was doing the wine blog, and it was every single day, and he would try a good wine and he would spit it out into his Jets football helmet. I mean, it was fun, but I didn't know he had all that immediate success.
Yes, on the business side, he did. Like the business really grew exponentially, the wine business, through that time.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. So yeah, you are all about like helping people see, follow the joy, and you don't necessarily have to work harder.
So I love what you're saying about this, and I have also like thought about this quite a bit, and so I remember years ago reading one of my favorite books, which I've mentioned on almost every podcast, is Parker Palmer's Let Your Life Speak. And it's a tiny little book, but it's packed with so much wisdom about following your calling and your giftedness and your vocation that's kind of beckoning you to listen. You need to listen to that stuff. And I remember in this book, he talks about the struggle. That like really understanding, and I can't remember exactly how he says it. There's one quote. He says, most of us arrive at a sense of self and vocation only after a long journey through alien lands. And it reminded me, Katarina, of what you were writing about. Like there is this illusion of struggle. And I think so many of us have to go through some version of that before we get to the oasis, before we find the thing, because we're so conditioned. Two things: we're conditioned to, that struggle is the way, and we're also conditioned to not listen to ourselves, to not listen to what's sparking joy, to not listen to our innate kind of internal voice and the direction we need to be going. And so that's why it's always, for me, has been a struggle. And I remember in my startup, I was running a technology startup, and it was insanely hard. And it was, I was going through so much burnout. I wasn't sleeping. It was unhealthy. I was yelling at people all the time. I was angry. Like, nothing was working. It was terrible. And I was like, well, this is the cost. This is the price you pay for success. So I'm just going to suck it up and power through. And it was devastating. And so, but I remember thinking, well, this is the way. This is what everybody tells you you have to do. And so now the work that we're doing with Big Self School is, there's certainly challenge in it, you know, but flow, being in flow, is this kind of balance between challenge and creativity. And so that's where there's joy for me. So there's still challenge, but it's not struggle and devastation. And I think that's the difference. And so I love that you're building a case for that. And you're really putting some data around that idea. So I'm thankful for it. And I think you've given me a lot to think about with that article.
I love it. I wrote down the book you recommended. I love that you shared your story. And then what happened? You realized that Big Self was a better option. You feel more in flow of what brings the joy, and it doesn't feel like struggle. I love, because you brought a real life example about this. And my experience has been the same. Most of the burnout and the experience of my clients was happening when they were trying to do something they thought it was the right thing to do because the world around them thought that it was the right thing to do, but it wasn't the right thing for them to do.
Yeah. And even if it's noble, even if it's like, well, I'm doing something really important and I'm helping people, and I'm, you know, and our technology company was, you know, helping parents manage their kids' technology so that they could thrive as a family. So I was always like, this is important work, but it just wasn't my work. It wasn't the path for me to be on, but it did take a lot of struggle. And I find that people, you know, the whole first half of life, people who are still very much an ego, like I think I was, this lesson, this, what you're sharing in this article and what you're saying here, is really hard for people to accept, because they're just not there. They're not ready to surrender into ease. They're not ready to, believe that there's a different way, a better way. They still associate struggle with success. And so I think this is a very dangerous myth that we're certainly trying to bust open with what we're doing at Big Self School. So yeah, I love that.
Me too.
Well, Katarina, I mean, so I think part of the reason is that our culture sends mixed messages sort of on this very topic, doesn't it? There is this idea of we're learning from failure, or there's no such thing as failure. But sometimes to me, it feels like failure really is a thing. But again, like, you'll hear, like, before something great is born, you're going to, like, have the universe will be pushing against you.
There's chaos. Before, yeah, order.
Right.
Yeah.
So sometimes it is hard whether you're in your joy or not.
I think joy can be the compass, though, because it's a different thing of doing experiments, and some of them work and some don't. That's the creative process. Like, we write articles, some of them work, some don't. These are experiments. And as long as we enjoy what we're doing, we feel creative, it's not a failure. And then many times people come to me and they had real failures. Like, they were fired from the business. The business got bankrupt, and I help them build the narrative around this. And the key difference when someone is ready to move on versus someone that's stuck with this baggage of the failure is whether they are able to articulate the learnings. So if it feels horrible, and that's why I say joy can be a compass here to realize what type of failure it is, we articulate the learnings and then see what's the message. Should we be doing something different? Oprah had said failure is the universe's way to nudge you towards the right direction. Sometimes it is. But if we were enjoying what we were doing and some things don't work out, and I say this is not failure, it's an experiment. And this is the, of course, there is chaotic creative process. Creativity is not efficient. It's not it will lead to many dead ends. That's what creativity is. Even in the develop ideas part of my book, this is what I'm arguing. It's a different process, very divergent thinking. And that's not failure. That's just experiments.
Yeah, I tell people, and the way I think about it myself, this is the whole purpose of life. Like when people talk about what is my purpose, and it's not something that you have to go find or manufacture or engineer in some way. Like it's happening to you all the time. Your life is a laboratory of learning, and we want to diminish all of the stress and the chaos and the negative and the struggle, which I think is a noble goal, but I think we manufacture it too much, especially in our business environments and our startup environments. We attach so strongly to this belief that struggle's the way. And there's a whole other side to this conversation, which is you need joy too. Like you need both to have a purposeful life. Like you've got to be awake to all of it. And integrate all of it to really understand the full human experience. And so I just don't think that we talk about that as much, or we're the joy side, the ease side of it, or we're suspicious of it maybe, like it's too easy, it's too soft. So I think we've got to figure out how to blend that into not only a conversation, but I think blend that into our cultures as well that people work in.
And I think there's this book that's called The Happiness Advantage, that actually success follows happiness. It's not happiness following success. And you can see it in practical examples, right? If you two were not enjoying having this conversation or having this podcast, the podcast would not be as successful. And the same with writing, the same with a lot of creative pursuits. When you're enjoying it, people that will consume your product or what you create will see it, will notice the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and we are. You're right. Through the struggle, we're persisting and enjoying the ride. And you know, I think that that's what you're doing with LeaderPath. You guys are doing some different stuff and popularizing this idea, helping it be better known. Could you tell us a little bit about LeaderPath that you founded, and how can people reach out and get in touch?
Of course. So we are a team of executive coaches. We coach pioneering leaders and teams for impact and fulfillment. And we do this by working in two pillars. The first is clarity, where you are, where you're going, how to get there. And the second is leadership, how you get a team around you to help you achieve your purpose. And we touched on the key ideas today about the philosophy. For the leadership part, the lonely genius is a myth. And for the clarity, we do believe that 20% of your effort will produce 80% of the results. So we help people do less to achieve more. How can you focus and actually do less rather than burn out and do too many things? And our website is theleaderpath.com. We offer executive coaching, team coaching, and learning. And for your readers, this is the first time I created this page on the website, theleaderpath.com/mindset, I'm giving away a guide I created, the 10 mindset shifts to become a more successful leader. So this is the first time I'm sharing this landing page, is theleaderpath.com/mindset.
We will put that on the show notes.
Leaderpath.com/mindset. Yeah, we will link people to that in our show notes. So everybody be sure to look for that. Tell us about your book. When's it coming out? I'm really excited about this.
Coming out with Penguin.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Penguin.
Yes. It's coming out 15th of April. It's already available for pre-order, which Penguin forgot to mention to me. I found out by chance. I was on Amazon.
That's super important, is pre-orders.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I know that.
Yes, it's called Hold Successful Meetings. It's part of the Penguin Expert series. It's coming out 15th of April. If you do pre-order, I'm planning to get together in the next month or so a pack of bonuses too for the people that pre-order. But that's the book.
Awesome. And I guess pre-order everywhere books are sold?
Yes.
Okay. Great. And we'll help people find that as well.
That's super exciting. And yeah, I think, you know, it's, we talk about finding a niche or a niche, right? And I think that this is a powerful way to this book on meetings, to be able to talk about collaboration, to talk about higher levels of creativity and outcomes. So it sounds just terrific.
Yeah, I thought making it specific and concrete, rather than having a generic book on leadership or team creation, if you nail your meetings, it's the first domino. It's the keystone habit. Mm-hmm. So it helped me really focus and really make it actionable. Actually, what can you do in your next meeting? I thought that was valuable in terms of making it actionable for the readers.
Yeah. And most people, you know, they don't give enough thought to meetings. They think that that's just something you just figure out and you do. No, there's actually a roadmap here for better meetings. So I'm glad that you've written this book, and I think it's going to be, I think it'll be wildly successful because we need it. So thank you so much for being here. This is so great to have you and to get to know you and your work. And I think I know our paths will cross again, because especially these ideas that you're sharing around kind of the myth of hustle that's required for success. Like, I really want to keep following what you're saying around that. And I'm just grateful that you've been here and have shared it with our audience.
Thank you for having me. It's an extreme pleasure.
Yes, it is wonderful to have you. Thanks for taking the time. I think I want to focus my 20% for 80% outcome. Yes, that's a message that works for me.
That's right. Do less.
Yeah.
I heard that. I like that.
Awesome. Thank you, Katarina.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to the Big Self Podcast. This episode was brought to you ad-free by the Big Self School. And if you have been a part of the growing community from around the globe, 34 countries by last count that are following these episodes on a weekly basis, we love your presence. We are so glad you're listening. We hope this process is making a difference in your life. If you would be so kind as to help our online visibility by giving us a review on Apple iTunes, we would be deeply grateful. We're starting this podcast from scratch. We've been doing it for a year now, bringing content value to our listeners at least once a week. And your support, and even this one small way, well, I'm going to call it a big way. It's a big way, and it will make a big difference. Thank you, as always, for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.